has some impact here, but I can't give you a quantitative read on that.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
British High Court has overturned a ruling that prevented WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange from being extradited to the United States, ruling that he can be sent to the U.S. after Washington gave the court assurances that Assange's well-being would be protected were he extradited to the U.S. In January, the court rejected a previous extradition request on the grounds that moving Assange to the United States and isolating him would put him in danger of suicide. The 50-year-old Australian is wanted in the United States for disclosing confidential military and diplomatic records in 2010, which caused Washington great embarrassment. These documents included classified military and diplomatic information detailing U.S. bombing campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq, information about civilian deaths and secret U.S. drone strikes in Yemen. In face of American officials' denial, he may face up to 175 years in jail if convicted. After being locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for 7 years, Assange was apprehended in 2019. He was not present in court, despite his denials of any wrongdoing. He has been held at London's high-security Belmarsh prison for more than 2.5 years. During his High Court appeal in October, Assange had a stroke. The stress of the ongoing U.S. court case against him, as well as a general decline in his health as he approaches his third Christmas behind bars, is said to have precipitated the stroke. Advocates for press freedom have also voiced alarm over the verdict. Reporters Without Borders is concerned about the repercussions for journalism and press freedom throughout the world. RSF also urged Washington to finally drop its long-running case against the journalist.
The U.S. is basically extraterritorializing its laws. It's saying that even if you don't live in the United States, you don't work in the United States, you're not from the United States, if you publish documents the United States doesn't like, they will come get you. And, you know, you can be threatened with 175 years in jail. And they're trying to make an example out of him to scare other people. That's the point that they're making here. At the same time, I just argue one thing. Ironically, in a sense, although Assange's case is unique, it's not unique in terms of assurances because the United States always does this. It always lies to other countries. It lies to other judges, to other jurisdictions, in order to get people into the U.S. And, you know, whether it's through the courts or by kidnapping and rendition, which we've seen the U.S. do a lot, They just kidnap people overseas and render them they bring them to the United States. One way or another, they will find a way to get people in U.S. jurisdiction because they know once you're there, no one is going to help you, no one is going to do anything. And that's the message they're sending here. It's that other countries need to stay in line. You need to hand over anyone we ask you to hand over, whether it takes 10 years, 15 years, you're going to hand them over. And journalists should be scared of publishing documents the U.S. doesn't like.
It appears that the U.S. is attempting to use Assange as a fear tactic to ensure that comparable information concerning its misdeeds is not revealed again. According to Assange supporters, Washington has been discreetly manipulating events, only revealing itself when it filed an extradition request in 2019. According to them, There were several indications that the U.S. was pursuing vengeance on Assange rather than justice. The U.S.'s claims may have far-reaching ramifications for journalism's future and its capacity to hold governments accountable. The U.S. certainly wants to make sure that such a leak would not happen again. The English courts have now sparked outrage by seemingly giving permission to political persecution. Critics fear that the precedent would mean that any journalist in the UK or other parts of the world may now be brought to the US for punishment if they cause Washington sufficient embarrassment.
I think that the US is using its judicial overreach as a way to intimidate people, including journalists, including diplomats, including economic leaders of countries which are not in their favor.
The issue is that if Assange can be imprisoned for performing journalism, why can't the editors of other papers? This is undoubtedly a significant setback for journalistic freedom. On Friday, a bipartisan group of leading members of the U.S. House Committee on Foreign Affairs passed a bill aimed at restricting Iran's defensive military prowess. The Stop Iranian Drones Act would ban the supply, sale, or transfer of military drones to or from Iran under U.S. law. The bill addresses what the U.S. claims to be the growing threat of Iran's unmanned aerial vehicle program. However, despite gaining self-sufficiency in the arms industry by making great progress in developing and manufacturing a broad range of military equipment in recent years, Iran has time and again proven that its military capabilities are purely defensive in the face of moves by the U.S. and its regional allies, which have been fomenting chaos and tension in the region. Like last month, when the Iranian army intercepted two U.S. unmanned aerial vehicles that had penetrated the country's airspace, giving them a stern warning to stay away from the zone where it was holding massive drills. The ban imposed on the Iranian military drones comes amid ongoing talks over the removal of anti-Iran sanctions between Tehran and the signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal in Vienna. The U.S. has for long tried to tie Iran's military capabilities to the talks. However, the Islamic Republic has repeatedly underscored that its defensive capabilities will be never subject to negotiations. The U.S. also baselessly accuses Iran of conducting drone attacks in West Asia, while Washington has blood on its hands for killing thousands of innocent civilians by conducting drone and airstrikes in the region. Also, let's not forget that the United States is the leading exporter of arms in the world. Washington attempts to restrict Iran's defensive capabilities while it sells bombs, drones, and arms to other countries like Saudi Arabia that use them in unjust wars like the one in Yemen to kill innocent civilians. In fact, half of U.S. arms transfers between 2016 and 2020 went to West Asia region, particularly Saudi Arabia, leading to more instability and chaos. The U.S. is also guilty of civilian killings in many war theaters, like in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria, from drone strikes to other military action. Rights groups have accused Washington of hiding the real number of civilian casualties and underreporting them. Based on the U.S. military's own assertion, Washington has conducted almost 100,000 drone and air strikes in the West Asia region in the past 20 years, according to a new analysis published by the civilian harm monitoring group Air Wars. The U.S. strikes have killed at least 22,000 civilians across various theaters, including Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Somalia, Libya, Yemen, and Pakistan since 2001. The group says the number could probably be as high as 48,000. The U.S. also assassinated Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander Abu Mehdi al-Mohandes in a drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. The two were iconic figures in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. That's while top U.S. diplomats have previously admitted that Washington is responsible for the foundation of the Daesh terrorist group. Days after the Brazen Act, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launched a volley of missiles at a major military base housing American forces in Iraq. Iran denounced the assassination as a state terrorism and vowed to end the American presence in the region as the ultimate act of revenge.
Well, clearly, if one was going to have a completely honest and neutral legal international legal system, no country can stand above it. But we don't have that. And in fact, we have a system where the people who've got the arms and the money make the decisions. So obviously, if we were to say that any time a country used a drone and killed other civilians, there was going to be sanctions, clearly those countries that have drones, in particular this country, would have to be sanctioned. But that's simply not going to happen.
Political dynamics in West Asia have been undergoing an overhaul since earlier this year when U.S. President Joe Biden announced his country will withdraw its troops from Afghanistan following 20 years of war, and Washington's Western allies followed suit. Just this week, U.S.-led forces ended their combat mission in Iraq, switching to advisory roles in the country. The departure of foreign troops comes amid growing anti-West sentiments in the region and a shift in the focus of Washington's foreign policy from West Asia to China and Russia. That has brought the regional countries together to address the challenges facing the region. One instance is Qatar, which had been under a blockade by Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, Egypt, and the United Arab Emirates since June 2017. That went on until January this year, when the quartet agreed to end the diplomatic row. In the meantime, Saudi Arabia and Egypt have appointed new ambassadors to Qatar. Trade and travel links have also been reestablished with Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and Egypt, but not with Bahrain.
He has noticed that this American support is limited to just maintaining Saudi Arabia as an outpost of military, of U.S. imperial projection and power play in the region. And of course, when this U.S. support were to be removed or to be reduced, Saudi Arabia, as well as the UAE, as well as Bahrain, as Qatar, and Kuwait, they need more pillars to work with. They need more legs to stand on, and one of the best things to do in this region is collaborate and cooperate with the governments already exist and try to bridge the differences that might exist between various countries.
Qatar's emir has traveled to Saudi Arabia and met Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman several times since then. On Wednesday, bin Salman made his first official visit to Qatar since he was named Crown Prince in 2017. A senior official at the Iranian Foreign Ministry says the development of ties and cooperation with the neighboring countries is among the priorities of the new administration in Tehran. Alireza Inayati says trips and negotiations by the Iranian officials in recent months are all proof of that policy. He says Iran has good ties with the Persian Gulf Arab states, including the UAE, Oman, and Kuwait. Inayati heads the Iranian Foreign Ministry's Office for Persian Gulf Affairs. He was speaking with the Iranian Arabic news channel Al Alam. Inayati also said Iran and Saudi Arabia have held four rounds of talks since September to mend their ties and plan more negotiations. He cited progress in the talks, saying they were friendly and constructive. Ties severed between Tehran and Riyadh in 2016. The two have differences on some regional issues, including the Yemen war. For years, the kingdom pursued a confrontational foreign policy toward the Islamic Republic, but it has recently appeared to have changed track.
When it comes down to it, they are two nations that border the Arab Gulf. They're two nations that are in a very strategic area, who border the Gulf region, border the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz. So these all areas that are of a vitally strategic importance. And when push comes to shove, it is them who have to live there, not the United States, not the United Kingdom or the European Union or any of these Western powers. It is the Iranians, it is the Arabs, the Saudis, the Iraqis, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris who have to live in this region, have to find a way to keep on living. This is something that I believe a couple of years ago that the Iranian government already said, and when it comes down to it, this should be a regional decision.
The recent developments in the region signal a paradigm shift in the ties between West Asian countries. The jury is still out on what that would mean for the United States' interests and influence in the region.
Germany has a new chancellor. Social Democrat Olaf Scholz has been sworn in as Germany's new chancellor, ending 16 years of conservative rule under Angela Merkel. Scholz, who is now 63, had served as vice chancellor and finance minister in Merkel's outgoing government. He got 395 votes from lawmakers in the lower house of parliament. Scholz will oversee a liberal-left coalition government between the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, the Greens, and the Liberal Free Democratic Party, or the FDP. This is the first power-sharing agreement of such a kind in Germany, and the first governing alliance with three parties since 1957. Merkel's final days as chancellor was her 5,860th day in office, falling short of the record set by her late former mentor, Helmut Kohl, by a mere 10 days.
Well, the positive is that she kept the German economy strong. Germany is still an export powerhouse. There are signs of a certain weakening, but still its position is very strong. She left very popular, which is very important. Clearly, Germans liked her steady, somewhat conservative leadership, and she certainly established Germany as the preeminent power in the European Union.
The alliance brings to a close 16 years of rule by Angela Merkel, who chose not to run again. Germany's incoming government has agreed that EU authorities should act more urgently to defend the rule of law, including withholding EU funds if necessary.
I mean, the pressures that are pulling apart the EU are growing. After Brexit, people became frightened and decided, that maybe leaving the EU was not such a great idea. But now these centrifugal forces are reasserting themselves. The EU is torn between East and West, North and South, but the East European countries are pushing a much more confrontational policy vis-a-vis Russia. They're allying themselves with the United States, and France and Germany are caught in the middle. And they're kind of trapped, and they aren't sure what to do.
The new government has ambitious plans to fight climate change by phasing out coal early and focusing on renewable energy, but their initial priority will be tackling the coronavirus pandemic. Angela Merkel served alongside four U.S. presidents, four French presidents, five British prime ministers, and eight Italian premiers. Her chancellorship was marked by four major challenges: the global financial crisis, Europe's debt crisis, the 2015-16 influx of refugees to Europe, and the coronavirus pandemic. While credited with securing huge European bailouts that saved Greece from crashing out of the Eurozone, it was achieved at a heavy social cost. Merkel was highly unpopular for being the driving force behind bailouts and austerity cuts. The policy made millions of people jobless, plunging them into poverty. Merkel also kept Germany's borders open to hundreds of thousands of refugees fleeing the wars in Syria and Iraq. But the policy drew criticism from right-wing politicians. The refugee influx gave a good excuse to far-right groups to fan the flames of Islamophobia. Popular anger also sent the far-right bloc, the anti-immigration AfD, to parliament in 2017 for the first time since World War II, making it the biggest opposition force. Merkel's government was accused of protecting Germany's vital automobile industry by watering down emissions regulation reforms, and its refusal to advance the 2038 deadline to quit coal energy, also irking green activists.
And she's been caught in the middle of a lot of conflicts and has not acquitted herself especially well. And that includes Ukraine and Iran, especially the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord. Germany under Merkel mostly towed the U.S. line and did not get very many rewards for it. They lost business opportunities in Iran, and they have been kind of chained to an increasingly erratic U.S. policy.
Her government also did not play a constructive role after the nuclear deal with Iran in 2015. Germany under Merkel practically followed the maximum pressure campaign of the U.S. against Iran and did not fulfill its obligations under the deal.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
One thing appears reasonably certain. This new wave, in whatever iteration, will likely exercise the peak of its lethality within the ranks of those who believed Trump's tall tales about rounding the turn, says William Rivers Pitt, journalist, in an article published under the heading, "As more info emerges on Omicron, Trump's old COVID lies continue to kill people." Stay tuned for more. On October 27, 2020, then-President Donald Trump stood before a mostly maskless assemblage of adoring fans and declared the nation was rounding the turn on the COVID-19 pandemic. It was the 40th time he had made this claim in the last 57 days, and it was no more true then than it is now. The average daily infection rate at that time stood around 85,000 new cases per day. Today, over 121,000 cases a day, with a daily death toll back above 1,200. A lot of Trump's people at that time fully believed his negligently homicidal claims about that corner, and many of them still do. Not as many now, of course. Some have come to embrace the science, but tens of thousands of Trump supporters have been killed by this thing, by Trump's flippant dismal of it all. Because of this, there will in all likelihood never be a corner to turn. Endemic is the hot word among COVID epidemiologists these days, which is science speak for pretty much forever. Since May 2021, people living in counties that voted heavily for Donald Trump during the last presidential election have been nearly three times as likely to die from COVID-19, reports NPR. The trend was robust even when controlling for age, which is the primary demographic risk of COVID-19 mortality. The data also reveal a major contributing factor to the death rate difference. The higher the vote share for Trump, the lower the vaccination rate. Now comes the ominously titled Omicron variant, cousin to the Delta variant that is presently spreading all over the U.S. Omicron has been confirmed in 66 countries all over the world and in 22 U.S. states. COVID experts are laying themselves out trying to answer a number of pressing questions. How transmissible is Omicron? Are the symptoms worse than Delta? Will the vaccines still work? A sobering portrait of the Omicron variant is emerging from the first burst of lab studies on the coronavirus' latest incarnation, showing that
the mutated virus can slip past a shield of protection provided by the standard two-shot vaccine regimen, reports the Washington Post. This is but one of the studies that are taking place, as yet to be peer-reviewed and rigorously confirmed. There are also suggestions that the symptoms of Omicron could be mild in comparison in those of Delta or the original strain. More than 40 people in the U.S. have been found to be infected with Omicron variant so far, reports the Associated Press, and more than three-quarters of them had been vaccinated. The chief of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said recently, but she said nearly all of them were only mildly ill. We can speculate all we wish about the possible need for boosters amid a mild symptom fifth wave of infections, but we won't have solid data about Omicron until all testing has been completed and reviewed. Even then, the variant's long-term effects will remain unknown. One thing appears reasonably certain, however. This new wave, in whatever iteration, will likely exercise the peak of its lethality within the ranks of those who believe Trump's tall tales about rounding the turn. If Trump had a single cure for the people who make him possible, he would embark on a vaccination campaign in all the states he carried in 2020. But he will not do this unless forced to. He will squat in his Bedminster lure plotting revenge, even as those he owes his power to die preventable death every day. It did not have to be this way, but here they are. Perhaps, after another winter of illness, suffering, and doubt, at least some of those who embrace Trump's denial of science will find their way out of that fog.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Following the Holy Prophet in justice.
This is part of the speech delivered on October 24th, 2021 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic and foreign participants in the 35th International Islamic Unity Conference.
با دشمن هم حتی بایستی شما با عدالت رفتار.
Even an enemy should be treated fairly. So this is another task, and this is primarily our responsibility. Whatever decision you make and whatever regulation you make, whether in the Islamic Consultative Assembly, where you pass laws, in the government, or in various other positions of management throughout the country, one of the most important things you take into account should be the issue of justice. You should think, is this in accordance with justice or not? Sometimes it is necessary to prepare an attachment describing justice for that regulation so that it becomes clear that this regulation and law is being implemented in accordance with justice. This is the second point. However, If we wish to observe justice, it should be noted that justice is not just about the distribution of property and wealth. Justice and fair treatment should be witnessed in everything.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
امروز توی فضای مجازی انسان گاهی اوقات بی‌عدالتی مشاهده می‌کنه. خلاف میگن، تهمت میزنن، دروغ میگن، قول به غیر علم میگن، اینا بی‌عدالتی است. اینا نباید انجام بگیر.
In the internet today, one sometimes witnesses injustices. They say untrue things, they slander, they lie, they promise without knowledge. These are acts of injustice, and these things should not be done. A person who works with the internet needs to watch over himself, and those who control the internet need to be even more vigilant to ensure that such things do not happen. We should learn and get used to treating people fairly.
شما ممکنه با یه نظری بد باشید رو قبولم نداشته باشید حیبی نداره نظر شماست ممکنه نظر درستی هم باشه اما این رو با تهمت با دروغ با اهانت با این چیزا نبایسته آلوده کرد
Even when you speak if you are not on good terms with someone and you do not share their viewpoint it is all right it is your opinion it may be the right opinion but it should not be contaminated with slander lies, insults, and the like. It is very bad to contaminate one's viewpoint with these things. These statements were about justice.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
About you, IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
EU Foreign Affairs Ministers gathered in Brussels on Monday for their final scheduled meeting of 2021. They accused Moscow of massing troops near Ukraine's border in preparation for a possible invasion.
The ministers, all of them, has been very clear today that any aggression against Ukraine will come with political consequences and with a high economic cost for Russia.
Moscow denies it intends to invade Ukraine and accuses Kiev of Western-backed provocation. Many analysts say the EU's undying support for Ukraine is nothing short of scandalous. Just last September, the European Court of Auditors, the 27-nation bloc's financial watchdog, published a report showing that corruption in Ukraine is rife at the highest levels amongst politicians, the judiciary, and state-owned enterprises. The report states that since 2014, EU taxpayers have sent 12.5 billion euro to Kiev via the European Commission, but corruption reform efforts have failed. New sanctions against Russia being considered by the EU include travel bans and asset freezes targeting politicians. The Federation's banking sector could be hit. Perhaps the new gas pipeline between Russia and Germany might be blocked from becoming operational. The Kremlin has warned against further provocation. Despite all the rhetoric, analysts point out that the EU and Russia are major trading partners, particularly in the area of energy.
I think that very existence of this strong economic interconnectivity is encouraging to look for the ways for the better political relations.
Those relations are currently at an all-time low and will be the subject of much debate when EU leaders hold a summit here in the Belgian capital this Thursday. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Prisoners' advocacy groups and prisoners' rights activists have held a sit-in in solidarity with Palestinian prisoners suffering in Israeli prisons and detention centers. The sit-in, which took place inside the Red Cross office in Gaza, comes only one day after the Israeli regime renewed the administrative detention order of Hisham Abu Hawash, who has been on hunger strike protesting his administrative detention for nearly 4 months. Some 500 Palestinian prisoners are being held in Israeli jails under administrative detention. Administrative detainees are incarcerated based on secret evidence without charge or trial for long periods of time.
Administrative detention has been an Israeli policy for decades in order to break the will of Palestinian prisoners. Israel, as an occupying power, used administrative detention to illegally hold thousands of Palestinians behind bars without charge or trial. The apathy of the international community has encouraged the Israeli regime to violate the rights of Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners are kept in 24 Israeli jails and detention centers and are being subjected to torture and psychological pressures by Israeli prison authorities. They include women and children as well as elderly prisoners.
Currently, there are 39 female prisoners in Israeli jails, including 10 mothers. They also include sick and wounded female prisoners. The detention conditions inside Israeli jails are extremely bad, especially for women and children. Israeli prison guards target female prisoners and humiliate them all the time.
According to legal experts, Tel Aviv has long considered itself above international law and conventions due to the protection it enjoys from some countries like the United States. Currently, around 4,500 Palestinian prisoners are being held in Israeli custody under inhumane conditions.
At least 4,500 prisoners are held inside Israeli jails under horrible detention conditions. We demand that Israel be held accountable for its violations against Palestinian prisoners. Israel must treat Palestinian prisoners in accordance with the Fourth Geneva Convention and other international treaties regarding prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners are political prisoners, and they are regarded as heroes and freedom fighters by all Palestinians. According to the latest statistics, Israel has imprisoned over 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Thousands of Palestinians are currently behind bars and languishing in Israeli prisons. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
Back-to-back scandals are taking their toll on the popularity of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his ruling Conservative Party. An opinion poll shows support for Conservatives is down 4 points to 32%. That gives the opposition Labour Party a 9-point lead, their largest since 2014. Johnson's own ratings are also at their lowest since his party won a landslide in 2019. His popularity is 14% down in 2 weeks. A video was leaked this week showing Downing Street staffers joking about a Christmas party held there last December while the country was under COVID lockdown. The scandal has already led to the resignation of Johnson's spokeswoman, Allegra Stratton.
My remarks seemed to make light of the rules. Rules that people were doing everything to obey. That was never my intention. I will regret those remarks for the rest of my days, and I offer my profound apologies to all of you at home for them.
The British Prime Minister has denied that there was a party and apologised for the video.
I apologise for the impression that has been given that staff in Downing Street take this less than seriously. I'm sickened myself and furious about that.
While the leaked video was the talk of town, reports came out about two more lockdown gatherings at the Downing Street, including one at Johnson's own flat. A probe is now underway into whether the parties broke COVID rules. The Premier is facing calls to step down.
Downing Street willfully broke the rules and mocked the sacrifices we have all made, shattering the public's trust. The Prime Minister has a duty, the only right and moral choice left to him. It is for his resignation.
Yeah. Labour leader Keir Starmer is strongly critical of Johnson too.
But there's also this basic question of trust, and that is broken with the Prime Minister, okay. And that's why he is unfit for office.
In recent months, the British Prime Minister has faced criticism over other issues, including his handling of a sleaze scandal, the awarding of lucrative COVID contracts, and the refurbishment of his Downing Street flat. That's beside revelations Johnson intervened to evacuate pets from Kabul during the chaotic Afghan withdrawal in August. Now the latest scandal involving the lockdown parties may be the final nail in the coffin as Johnson's popularity continues to plummet. More than half of those taking part in the latest opinion poll believe that the Premier should step down.
Iran's lead negotiator at the Vienna talks aimed at reviving the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, says his team has not yet received any proposal or initiative from the other side to help resolve the outstanding issues.
Both on the issue of sanctions removal and nuclear measures, there have been disagreements. These are clearly visible in the draft that was achieved following the previous round of talks. The disagreements, especially on the nuclear issue, are numerous and varied. On these disagreements, we have not yet received any proposal or initiative from the other side.
In the past days, questions have arisen about the drafts being discussed and whether the Iranian team's amendments and proposals offered in the form of two written drafts at the beginning of the seventh round are still on the table.
Over the past few days, we have had various meetings at the levels of experts and senior political directors during which the modifications, viewpoints and proposals of the Iranian side on the June 20th draft were discussed, and these discussions were positive and moving forward.
Iran says it would only go back to full compliance after the full and verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. And while some sources say the Iranian demands are stalling progress, others like Russia's lead delegate maintain the atmosphere is positive amid intensive dialogue.
The important thing for Iran is that the current negotiations move forward
and that all of the sanctions, the maximum pressure sanctions, are removed, and there's a verification process. And Iran really has to be compensated for all the damage that Western countries have done to the people of Iran.
On Sunday, a third working group focusing on the sequencing of compliance by all parties was held for the first time during the seventh round of talks. That was followed by a trilateral meeting between Iran, Russia, and China. There's been no official word yet about the duration of the current round of talks. Homolesky, Vienna.
The tragedies caused by the Saudi-led war on Yemen are going beyond the casualties of airstrikes and an ongoing blockade. The Yemeni Pediatric Society says the number of infants with birth defects has increased rapidly since the 2015 war that turned Yemen into a testing ground for internationally banned weapons.
The weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition against our country contain prohibited chemicals that directly affect pregnant women and fetuses. That has increased the birth rate of children with cancer and congenital anomalies, especially in the areas that are being continuously bombed, such as Sana'a, Hodeida, Hajja, and Sada.
Officials say chemical and biological bombs dropped from Saudi warplanes on Yemenis have made Yemen the world's worst epidemic disaster. They're calling for an investigation into recent cases of congenital anomalies.
Since the first day of the aggression, the Saudi-led coalition has used various types of prohibited weapons, including cluster and phosphorus bombs, to target residential and agricultural areas. As a result of environmental contamination, we witnessed a dramatic rise of congenital malformations among children. We demand the documentation of the pathological cases caused by these bombs to reveal Saudi Arabia's war crimes.
Infants are suffering difficult conditions in Yemen in the absence of essential medical supplies and healthcare facilities needed for their survival and well-being. Yemeni health centers have been in a dire situation since the start of the Saudi-led war.
As the war goes on, Yemeni children continue to be at the brunt of the death and destruction left behind by Saudi-banned weapons. People here believe that Riyadh has always been violating international law by using cluster munitions in bombing residential areas since it started its deadly war on Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The U.S. is stunned by a devastating storm of tornadoes that ripped through the six states of Arkansas, Illinois, Kentucky, Missouri, Mississippi, as well as Tennessee overnight. Strong thunderstorms triggered dozens of tornadoes that crumbled metal like paper, swatted down concrete buildings, and threw a freight train off its track. Among notable casualties are a candle-making factory in Kentucky, a nursing home in Arkansas, and an Amazon warehouse in Illinois. An Illinois resident explains how he was shocked by the extent of damage after he rushed to his mother's house.
The damage is worse than some of the stuff I've seen in war pictures, so it's pretty intense. You know, it's not anything that I thought when she called me and told me that, oh, all my trees are gone. I got here and I did not expect to see this.
The town of Mayfield in Kentucky was described as ground zero by officials and appeared post-apocalyptic. A restaurant owner says the town's residents have lost it all.
It was just, this is our hometown, and it just devastated. Everybody's lost everything.
Rescue workers across the middle of the country are combing through wreckage for survivors. Scores of deaths have already been confirmed, and officials warn that the toll is almost certain to rise as they are sifting through the ruins for the missing. President Joe Biden is going to travel to areas affected by what he's described as likely one of the largest tornado outbreaks in the American history.
I'm monitoring the situation very closely since early this morning. This is likely to be one of the largest tornado outbreaks in our history. It's a tragedy. It's a tragedy.
President Biden also said he would task the environmental agencies to take a look at the specific impact climate change might have had on the deadly tornadoes. A meteorologist says he has rarely seen anything like this tornado storm, during his career spanning four decades.
I was watching the radar last night, and I was saying, wait a second, this is December. How is this happening in December? This is the kind of thing you would only see at the height of the season, you know, March, April, May. I'd never seen anything like this this time of year. I mean, and you hardly ever see something like this in a career.
The tornadoes have left a trail stretching around 370 kilometers. The multi-state disaster has freshened debates about whether climate change had a role to play in triggering these tornadoes, which are believed to be quite unseasonal, and whether a warmer planet would mean the world should expect to see more disasters of the kind.
Afghans said the Taliban takeover of the country has not brought an end to terrorist attacks there. In addition to three large mosque blasts, recently IED bomb attacks have been continuously taking lives in the capital, Kabul. People say they're worried about such time-to-time bomb attacks, most of which carried out by Daesh.
People thought that bomb attacks will come to an end after the Taliban takeover, but we still do not feel safe. We live in the west of Kabul. Here, we witness explosions every week. We ask the Islamic Emirate to take the security seriously.
Yesterday, an explosion hit a civilian vehicle here. Many were killed and wounded. Recently, people have been fearful of roadside and IED bomb attacks. The terrorists place bombs inside buses and everywhere, so people don't dare to take a bus or walk safely.
But Taliban officials have stressed that there is no place for Daesh or other terrorist groups in Afghanistan.
There is no active or observable terrorist group in Afghanistan. The Islamic Emirate has strong control over Afghanistan. No group or individual dares to stand against the Islamic Emirate or threaten the nation. However, there have been sporadic movements under the name of Daesh to create terror, but our forces are following them and will dismantle them soon.
The waves of terror attacks come as the Afghan society is struggling with unemployment, poverty, and hunger. People say they're disappointed, being hit by all these catastrophes. On Friday, here in western Kabul, two explosions hit civilian targets, killing two and injuring at least four. The attacks were claimed by Daesh terrorist group. The continuation of such incidents is raising concerns among the people. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
It was only last month when the statements by Lebanon's then Information Minister George Kordahi made headlines. In a televised interview recorded in August, before his appointment as a minister, Kordahi said the war in Yemen was futile and that Saudi Arabia and the UAE were the aggressors in that conflict. But it didn't take long for him to become the target of an unprecedented pressure campaign conducted by Saudi Arabia and its allies. In a bid to ease the tensions, Kordahi decided to leave office, a move he says he did not feel good about in the first place.
When I resigned, I did not feel good about being forced to step down. If Lebanon did not have these current problems and crisis and bankruptcy, I would have no reason to resign. And the government could have opposed my resignation and the whole Lebanese nation would have rejected it. For 40 days, I was under pressure from all sides, forcing me to resign. I resisted for 40 days. I could have resisted for 40 years, but I needed to consider the national interests.
Kordahi says he resigned to put the interest of Lebanese people first, but he says he's surprised at the extent of the influence external players exerted to make him step down.
We have hardly ever seen a government demanding the resignation of a minister or an official in another country, or setting it as a condition where a country has no choice but to comply. This has not happened, but in Lebanon, it is the second time that such a thing is happening. I have not disrespected anyone. 2 months before a ministerial appointment, I said something that was in favor of all parties without hurting anyone. Now I feel I have been oppressed.
The former Lebanese minister says his resignation has been a bargaining chip. The French President Emmanuel Macron has used to open talks with Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. Throughout the whole interview, Kordahi stresses his firm stance on his previously stated views.
I have borne the cost of my position on the Lebanese resistance and Syria throughout the past 10 years. Today, I also paid the price of my position on Yemen, and I am proud of it. Each media activist is the voice of the people and should not hide the truth.
And when asked if he would retract the statements triggering his forced resignation, he says he would not back down.
I will repeat the same remarks, because I spoke in good faith and did not say anything to offend anyone. This war, the war in Yemen, is an erosive war for both of these countries and all aggressors. Therefore, I demand an end to this years-long war.
Qardahi resigned for criticizing years of devastating war, a war that has taken the lives of hundreds of thousands of Yemeni people, displacing millions, and creating a dire situation that is described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
The death of India's Chief of Defense Staff, Bipin Rawat, his wife and 11 others in a chopper crash on Wednesday made big news across the subcontinent. The report went viral on social media and received huge attention region-wide. Following the incident, a female staffer at one of the Kashmir's leading banks received suspension for what they described as, quote, inappropriate reaction to a social media post about the death of the Chief of Defense Staff, unquote. People in Kashmir are criticizing the suspension, saying this is a violation of their rights to free speech.
I am not judging her reaction, but emoji symbols are sometimes sent by mistake, since touch screens are highly sensitive. This is highly undemocratic on the part of Kashmir officials.
In the Indian-administered Kashmir, government offices and semi-government institutions have issued circulars and updated codes of conduct cautioning employees against posting anything critical of India or its rule in the region. Scores of people in Kashmir have removed their social media posts out of fear of police action. A police officer who didn't want his name to be disclosed said that only posts that can attract a lot of attention or encourage disruption of public order are being assessed, since Kashmir is a sensitive region. However, analysts say authorities in Kashmir are trying to control the narrative to justify India's decision to end Kashmir's special status in August 2019.
This is depiction or reflection of sense of insecurity which has overtaken Indian state, because they feel if they allow people to express freely, the reality of Kashmir will get exposed before whole of the world.
India is increasingly using its anti-terror laws since the Hindu nationalist party, Bharatiya Janata Party, came to power in 2014. In Kashmir alone, over 2,300 people have been booked under the law since 2019, and half of them are still in prison. Global human rights bodies, including the United Nations, slammed India last month for arresting Kashmir's human rights activist Khurram Parvez under its anti-terror law. India has dismissed the UN charges as baseless, but people and analysts say repressive techniques are being used to suppress dissent in Kashmir. Shahanabad, Indian-administered Kashmir.
The limelight.
The U.S. is selling Saudi Arabia $650 million worth of missiles and providing $500 million worth of maintenance for U.S.-made aircraft, training, and other support for its military operations. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kerry Peterson-Smith Ryder. This article is published under the heading Saudi Arabia Arms Sales is one of Biden's many militaristic actions in first year. Stay tuned for more. Given the brutish approach of his predecessor, many expected President Joe Biden to shift away from the worst practices in U.S. foreign policy and at the border in the previous 4 years. Indeed, in the first weeks of his presidency, the Biden administration signaled changes. In Secretary of State Antony Blinken's first press briefing, the State Department announced that it was reviewing weapons sales to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, which have led the catastrophic war in Yemen with essential U.S. partnership. A week later, Biden declared in his first foreign policy address as president that